House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources to order. Sorry about getting a little bit late, but I had the opportunity to be the chair of the education one. I couldn't get it stopped. So just before this, Sam Verum, so I accept full responsibility for that. So today we have what I believe is a wonderful opportunity to get to hear some more information. And I just want to say that one of the real reasons at this session, at the beginning, to keep committees working and not have as many floor sessions was so that the committees get to know each other and also get to know more information about what's going on in the different committees' stuff. And this is one of those days. So I'm going to open an informational hearing with the Board of Agriculture and the State Agriculture Report, which is kind of our first one. So invite some people. And I do want to really make a statement. All of us, I think, were kind of shocked. I just met Bernie Faber a few weeks ago and helped get this all set up. And he had a heart attack. He's doing really well, I just heard, back home. And I am really pleased to hear that part of the whole story. But it was certainly a shock to us when we found out. And so Ken is here as the vice chair, and I really appreciate that. So thank you, and I'll turn it over to Katie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. Thank you for your kind thoughts about Bernie. Believe me, he's very upset that he couldn't be here today. takes a lot of pride in his service as chair of the board, and especially on this topic that we're going to visit with you about today. So we'll share your comments back to him. We are before you today to deliver the first State of Oregon Agriculture Report to the legislature and to the governor. And Jessica Hamilton from the governor's office is here today on behalf of the governor to receive the report. This is an effort that basically came out of some legislation passed during the last legislative session that moved the State Board of Agriculture from being merely an advisory body to a policy-making body similar to the Economic and Community Development Commission. And just as the Economic and Community Development Commission does a biennial report on Oregon's economy, the State Board of Agriculture now has the responsibility of doing a biennial report on the state of Oregon agriculture. So you have before you the very first one, and what I would like to do is turn it over to Ken Bailey, who is our vice chair, and he can just kind of give some highlights. As you can see, it's a book, and by no means are we going to go through the whole thing, but I think Ken wanted to make a few remarks, and then if there's any questions that the committee might have.
The committee would ask that before you leave that you sign all of them. That is asked so we can have this as a memento. So we'd appreciate it if you wait around for a signing.
Well, thank you very much. I'm Ken Bailey. I'm a cherry grower from the Dalles and vice chairman of the Board of Agriculture. And we're very pleased of the change of status of the board. Several of us, and Bernie was one of the instigators early on of when his tenure on the board to have the board be more active and more meaningful for the department and for the agriculture industry. And part of that is this report to the legislature and to the governor. This document is, as Katie pointed out, it's got a lot of detail in parts of it. We made some attempt to keep it short, but at the same time, agriculture is so diverse that we found that it's very difficult to make it very short and not be leaving out some major piece. What we've got in the, I'd like to point out is in the early part of the document, of course, the table of contents, but there's an executive summary on several pages there that'll give you the basic outline of what it is, and draw your attention maybe to page 13, which has some bullet points of the 20 major issues that we've identified facing agriculture industry today. And between those two documents, you'll get a flavor of what the main issues are, and the intermediate pages from there till the end go into lots of detail for reference and whatever. And of course, there's a short conclusion at the end that might be of interest to look at to begin with, and then, like I say, a lot of the middle piece may be something you want to go back to as a reference rather than unless you need it for a sleeping aid some evening to work your way through. But other than that, I think that's all I wanted to go to unless you've got questions on specific aspects. Thank you.
So, do you have anything to say from the governor's office?
Thank you very much. We look forward to reviewing it, and thanks for all your hard work.
So, do we have any questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to thank everyone for doing this and presenting this today. It's a great piece of work, and I look forward to reading it. We have no lack of reading material here. This one's important. I've always said the economy of our agriculture industry is important.
I'm excited. I think, from my perspective, just looking at the bullet points, a great framework for where the legislature and the board can come together to maybe try to solve some of those problems. And, you know, a good work list of things in the interim. It's kind of late to get it going now, but interim kinds of things and to work with the department and to work with the board would be really helpful in trying to identify ways in which we could help solve some of these issues or at least put in place what we need to solve some of those issues. And I guess the other big question that I would ask for a member who was on it before and on it now, what would you say the major differences since the board has transformed from last session?
I think to some degree the immediate change was not great because we've had to evolve a little bit and decide where we're going to go. As a matter of practicality, I know Bernie and I and some of the others that were on it before we changed, we were already moving to become more active and become more of what we were looking for official status of and to partially to show what we could do. And again, referring back to Bernie, sometimes you be careful what you ask for. You find that by having some of this stuff, you gain a little more responsibility, and that means there's more activities that you need to get involved with to keep it up to snuff. But I think it will raise the statue of the Board of Agriculture, make it more recognizable both by the industry and hopefully the rest of the state, and maybe the board can serve as a focal point, a facilitator for issues in agriculture to help bring agriculture together. Because it's such a diverse industry, we've got a lot of associations and commissions and various things throughout it, but we need to work together more often, and not that it hasn't been an effort before, but I think the Board of Ag can be a major facilitator of the industry to move forward.
I was going to say that when I look at it, I think of agriculture, and I think of one of the things you have all in common is soil. You got to have soil. But then I realize you got the crabbers, and you got the other people in here too. So it's not just the soil.
It's not just soil. I mean, especially even the nursery industry. There's some of that containerized nursery that, you know, they use a medium, but not necessarily soil as people think of it. But agriculture is more than a lot of people think, some of us think it's a lot more important to the Oregon economy than most people think, and so that's why we'd like to keep advertising it. A little bit of marketing goes a long way.
And Mr. Chair, I might just point out the bullets that you mentioned, the top 20 issues, many of those issues are in front of the legislature now in some form or another. Land use jumps out at me, transportation infrastructure, renewable energy. So a number of these topics you are dealing with now, we know that they are not just one-session topics. And I think I would reiterate what Ken said in terms of the industry being able to use the board as a unifying voice for the industry, because we are so diverse and we have challenges, I think, at times with the industry, and I think the industry recognizes that they can use the board as a tool in that way.
One additional comment on the report, and as far as the report and also the board itself, if the legislature or anyone else that's using this report find something lacking or find something that here is unnecessary, which this is our first report, of course, and it's a stab at it. We think it's a good report, but we're not going to be offended if somebody would say that we should do something in this a little differently to be more helpful to somebody. We're open to looking at adding or changing how we do this. If this was what others can make useful or not, we'd appreciate comments after you've had a chance to read at it. If you think of something that would improve it, we'll certainly look at that for our next editions of this report down the road.
The only other thing I was going to ask you, you have all of the board members listed on page one, and it talks a little about where they come from, which is a fairly diverse group. But do we have an idea of who they are, what they do, outside of just being on this board and having to work?
Well, I do. I'm not sure.
Do you want to share that? Would you share?
I could quickly go down the list. Bernie Faber, our chair, is a dairyman in West Salem. Been involved in a lot of the dairy industry issues. Myself, I'm a cherry grower from the Dalles. Also been involved in a lot of our tree fruit industry things, as well as Farm Bureau, and also somehow got myself tied up in the Big Look Task Force proceedings as well, which I was talking to Representative Smith about a little earlier. I like that role better than the Fairness Commission that she's on. I think we're a little more out of the loop at the present time. Maybe we will get there, but hopefully she will help solve the issue before we get down to the... Doug Kramer is a mostly a blueberry farmer, but he also represents the conservation districts of the state as chair of the conservation district State Conservation District. Dan Carver is a cattleman sheep grower from southern Wasco County in Maupin. Pat Dudley, a wine grower from West Salem area. Tom Fessler, basically nurseries, but also has some row crop interest in the Mount Angel, Woodburn area. Jan Kearns is a diverse cattle and field crop, potatoes and so forth in Baker County. Bob Levy, onions and various other field crops in the Hermiston area. Jim Rue is a public member of the board, and Lynn Youngbar is also a public member. They have Jim has got a little bit of grass seed farm in the family, but his main occupation is other than agriculture. The board is made up of eight. Producer members and two public members. And Thane Dunson and Katie Kober are ex-officio members of the board.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, can I at least say hello to...
Sometimes when you're late, we don't let you do that.
I know, I'm sorry. Ken, one of his orchards is right next to ours.
Oh, okay.
Like about 4 feet across the mud road. So, nice to see you, Ken.
Yeah, good to see you.
I think the fascinating thing about Ken's operation, and frankly, our board members on the whole, the expertise in the areas that they get involved in, but Ken and his family's operation ships their cherries all over the world, multiple markets as well as the domestic market. And he also serves on the International Trade Commission.
Well, again, thank you, and thanks for this first edition, and I guess... Did you want your sign?
Sure.
Yeah. So if you want to do that before you leave, we really appreciate it, Ken. So,
autographs.
Other than that, thank you again for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We are embarrassing.
And we'll close our informational hearing. Here, we'll collect them all and send them over to your signature. Yeah, they were serious. Yeah. Patty was very serious.
I was very serious.
Here's one more.
It's the first one. This might be worth something.
Yeah, exactly.
As long as it's not worth more than $10.
Well, if the government keeps going, we might need
$10
anyway.
The signature.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we just have to hope your signature is not worth $10.
Yeah.
And we're assuming right now that it's okay.
Yet.
Yes.
If we make our farmers extinct, it'll still be worth something. Otherwise,
and we'll be starving then.
Yeah. Extinct ourselves.
Somebody will realize Safeway doesn't grow food.
So we will be opening a public hearing on 2520. And our first person to testify will be Don Schellenberger. And we'll have a short description.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2520 would amend the definition of Class 2 all-terrain vehicle to include motor vehicles being operated on a highway for agricultural purposes. The bill further requires operators of Class 2 all-terrain vehicles to use slow-moving vehicle emblems if operating on a highway. We've not received a fiscal impact statement nor a revenue impact statement as of yet.
Okay, Don.
Uh-oh.
Now that we have fire-safe cigarettes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Please be able to follow right behind the Board of Agriculture.
Yeah.
Very important to us.
Yes.
I'd also like to introduce Kurt Mazay from Tillamook. He'll be speaking as well. The issue that's before you today regarding Class 2A TVs was brought to us by Kurt. About a year ago, he wrote a letter to us indicating that he was also a dealer in ATVs, and ATVs that he was selling now were larger than the Class 1 ATVs and could present a problem. We'd have to say right up front that we haven't had any problems yet with being cited for illegal use of an ATV, but you know, if we don't do something about it, we surely will have the problem. It always seems they come sooner or later. So we were pleased to work with Kurt and get this legislation put together. And Representative Hannah was kind enough to introduce it for us. So I'll turn it over now to Kurt and let him tell you about the situation, and then we'll be happy to take questions following that.
Thank you.
You haven't signed by your name, so.
First off, I apologize for catching a cold yesterday, so if my voice breaks. I'm here today wearing these four distinctly different hats, a dairyman, a nurseryman, a cranberry grower, and a farm equipment dealer. After adding equipment dealer to the list, last year an issue presented itself concerning Class 2 ATVs and their ability to be fully utilized by the agricultural community. This issue is what brings me here today to discuss House Bill 2520. You've likely seen Class 2 ATVs such as John Deere Gators, Kawasaki Mules, or the Polaris Ranger at one time or another, doing work around farms, nurseries, parks, fairgrounds, and college campuses. And on page 2, there's some examples of those types of vehicles. You'll notice by looking through the specifications provided on these vehicles on the following pages 3 through 6 that all these fall outside of the Class 1 definition because they're heavier than the 800-pound limit. Several years ago, the Oregon statutes were amended to allow for Class 1 ATVs to be driven on public roads for agricultural uses under ORS 821.191. This amendment carries with it restrictions on who is to be driving and how they are to be driven and what qualifies as an exemption. So since that time, Class 2 ATVs have become more popular for on-farm use because of their ability to carry a larger load as well as a passenger safely. And you can see by looking at the pictures that the vehicles are useful for taking feed to livestock, moving nursery plants, repairing irrigation, and hauling fruit bins, just to name a few tasks. They're highly efficient, narrow enough to fit down vineyard and berry rows, low enough to fit under orchard canopies, and light enough to spray fields when the ground is not yet firm enough for a tractor. Class 2 ATVs are very useful, but do not allow farmers the efficiency that would come with the exemption status of Class 1 ATVs for on-road agriculture use. Many of today's agriculture operations are spread out across rural areas, and HB 2520 would allow Class 2 ATVs to share the same status as Class 1 ATV and travel between farming operations. All restrictions would be identical to that of Class 1 ATVs, as noted in HB 2520. Thank you for your time.
Questions?
Mr. Chairman, Don Schellenberg.
Yes, Don.
Again, I would maybe just make a personal note here. In my written comments, what you have, I say it's a very common part of nearly every farm and ranch in Oregon, an ATV. I'm in the process of begging my wife to let me have an ATV.
They're pretty fun.
I have an orchard that I'm beginning to remove. And when you take the trunks out, all the roots don't come out with it. Well, then I plow the field, and now all the roots are on top. Again, it's very soft ground at that point, and I don't have an ATV, so I would need to use a heavy tractor, which would compact the soil back down again, which is not what I'm wanting to do. If I had an ATV with a box on it, I'd go along and pick up those roots and get those. I'm going to get them off there one way or the other. So just as an example of what a Class 2 ATV could be used for. We're here today, of course, asking for your support and passage of House Bill 2520, and would urge you to move that to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Oakley.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just for the record, against the conflict, I own several gators on my farm. Of course, I use the gator because it only goes a maximum speed of 18 miles per hour downhill with the wind behind it. So you cannot get injured on it.
Representative Plum.
Hey, Gary, I have a question. It could give me some trouble, but it does a forklift. Can you drive a forklift out on the road now if you've got to take it to another piece?
The way I understand it, that is an implement. It's designed for off-road use, and it doesn't fall into the statutes as an ATV, which is kind of as a default, these go to an ATV category under the Oregon statutes. So that's just my understanding. Yeah,
Mr. Chair, Representative Clement, would be an implement of husbandry.
So you could.
In that category, rather than... See, an ATV is not defined as an implement of husbandry.
Yeah.
And so it has its own special section.
So was the answer yes, you could drive a forklift?
Yes.
Okay, I feel much better. So
in a rural area from one place to another, you can drive.
Right, probably as long as you don't go more than a half mile.
Okay.
At least this is a restriction for implements of husbandry. Not more than a half mile, and you have to have... Or not more than a half mile without an SMV sign. You have to have an SMV sign on them.
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
He was talking about 18 miles an hour downhill. Try 1 mile an hour with the thing wobbling all over the place unless you put a bin on the front.
That's true. Okay, well, thank you very much.
I have some questions, Mr. Chair. I need to get better oriented to what's... I see that we have Class 1 and Class 2 ATVs, and I see photos here of Class 2s. What?
Class 1s are already... The statute exempts them, lets them...
But what is the difference? How does a kid in a Class 2 compare with a Class 1?
Mr. Chair... And Representative McPherson, maybe I should let the dealer tell that, but I mean, the Class 1s are your normal quads that they talk about, and the three-wheelers, that was the first of the ATVs.
Right.
Three-wheelers, and now they got the four-wheelers. It's less than 800 pounds and less than 50 inches in width.
Class 2 are the bigger ones.
Mm-hmm. Class 2 are larger than that, correct. And what you have there are the pictures of the Class 2.
Right. If I could, Mr. Chair. Yes. So the current law allows a Class 1 on the public road, but not a Class 2. So it permits a smaller vehicle, and this would actually allow a larger, presumably faster vehicle.
Probably slower.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, yes, it would allow the Class 2s that you see pictured there, which are larger than a Class 1. They're not necessarily faster.
I see. Larger.
Definitely. Okay. I might also add what the requirements are for moving them on a highway. You have to be a licensed driver. You have to drive on the extreme right-hand side edge of the road as close as possible. You have to have a working headlight and taillight. You have to have an SMV sign, and you can't travel over 20 miles an hour.
Right. If I could follow a further question, why weren't Class 2 ATVs allowed on the public road in the past?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Person, is because they weren't being built or utilized. Some were being built, but they've agriculture people in their ingenuity have discovered these things and found uses for them that you couldn't do with the smaller Class 1. And so they've become more popular and more useful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
We also have Dale Buck from the Farm Bureau. If anybody has a phone that's on, it doesn't have to be, it needs to be off because it picks up the feedback is often caused by it. Even if it's not ringing or you're not using it, it still can cause this little sound that's going off and affect us on our other feeds. Thank you, Mr. Buck.
Chairman Roblin and members of the House Ag and Natural Resource Committee, my name is Dale Buck. I live at 25590 Chinook Street, Cloverdale, Oregon, 97112, and I'm just here to ask your support for 2520. I'm a retired Tillamook County dairy farmer, and I have no use for one of these on my lot, but they would be useful to a lot of agriculture people.
Yep. Any questions for Mr. Buck? Thank you very much for your support.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here who did not sign up? Oh, Jim Welch. There is one more, at least.
Chair Roblin, committee members, I'm Jim Welch with the Oregon Cattlemen, and we certainly support this bill, and that's all we're going to include as testimony. Good bill, should pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Anybody else that came that has not signed up that would like to? Okay. Then we're going to close our public hearing on 2520. And I guess if there's anybody listening out there on the radio, if you have an interest or anything, we will be moving this bill, I think, fairly quickly. So best get some information to us if you have any concerns. I just don't think there are. We're going to now open up public hearing and work session on 2580. And we'll hear a short description.
That's what I have. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2580 would abolish the Western Oregon Onion Commission. There is no revenue impact, and we did receive a minimal fiscal impact statement on the bill.
Okay, and we have Bruce Andrews from the Western Oregon Onion Commission here. We seem to be having a group of these bills to have people say we don't need us anymore.
Mr. Chairman, Western Oregon Onion Commission clearly supports this bill, and thank you for forwarding it at our request. The Western Oregon Onion growers are actually going full circle. They started with an association, a collaboration of individual farmers back in the 50s, started raising onions, acres expanded, formed an original Danver Onion Commission, expanded from the mucklands, the heavy soil areas, up into the upland areas, and in the late 80s changed their name to the Western Oregon Onion Commission. From a high of about 3,200 acres, we are now down to somewhere around 800 acres. And instead of $45,000 in assessments, we're down to around $11,000 or $12,000. And the reality of it is we can do just as well as an association on a voluntary basis. And with probably less than a dozen farms that are participate in this process, it's really time to put this governmental body to bed. So with that, we would ask your help in helping us do so.
So any questions? Yes, Representative
Miles. I'm going to refer to my handy-dandy State of Oregon Agriculture.
And it's a good one, sir.
Right.
Now, on page 17, it is a summary of commodity status for 0506, and there are three categories for commodities: good, mediocre, and ugly. And the onions fall into the mediocre category, say struggling or holding steady, recovering an acre yields and prices, number nine in the list of commodities, $124 million. Is that an accurate statement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Miller, it probably is. I haven't seen or received an autographed copy of that booklet yet. But I suspect it's very accurate. But keep in mind that the Western Oregon Onion Growers is apart from the entire body of onions produced in the state of Oregon.
Okay.
We're a small specialty subgroup that is really located in the Salem, Silverton, Mount Angel area, where the bulk and majority of onions are really produced in eastern Oregon, either around the Hermiston area or around Ontario. And that's where the large acreage and the large value comes from.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions?
Yeah, it's interesting.
Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
So we are in a work session, and okay, I opened them both at the same time.
Oh.
So we'll do that. opinion, but that's okay. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2580, and we will open a work session on 2580. I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2580 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith moves House Bill 2580 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative
Smith. Mr. Chair, I just like this bill because it cleans up government, but also if you notice in line 13, any proceeds go to Oregon State University, sir. Thank you.
Not for me. Maybe reconsider now. Any other discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Boquist.
Aye.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative Dinkelder.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Chair Roblin.
Aye. The bill passes.
Want a motion for consent calendar?
Yeah. That should be. Yeah. Let's have a motion for consent calendar.
So, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2580 be considered for the consent calendar.
Do we have any people in opposition to that? Seeing none, I will move it to the consent agenda.
That means I don't get to say my OSU joke again.
That's right.
All right.
Thank you.
That was the purpose. That's right, Representative.
So, we will close our work session on 2580 and open a public hearing on 2114.
Like I said, I'm agnostic since I'm like UCLA. So.
And we'll have a short description by our administrator.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2114 would create the Stewardship Agreement Grant Fund to provide grants to carry out the purposes of stewardship agreements that are described in ORS 541423. Any grants awarded by the Board of Forestry must have matching funds, in-kind services, or other investments in the project, and provide a public benefit through improved water quality or improved fish and wildlife habitat. The bill also permits grants from the Flexible Incentives Grant Fund and the Watershed Improvement Grant Fund, and permits the Departments of Agriculture and Forestry to determine applicability of rules to particular landowners as part of a stewardship agreement. Finally, the bill exempts land management plans and stewardship agreements from disclosure as public record. There's no revenue impact that may have a fiscal impact, but we have not received a statement, and there is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, so our first person is Lanny Quackenbush from the Oregon Department of Forestry.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the House Ag and Natural Resource Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to spend just a few minutes today to kind of run down the intent and purposes of House Bill 2114. In 2001, the legislature directed the department, along with the Department of Ag, to recommend some improvements to existing incentives programs. There was a report submitted to the legislature in 2003 with recommendations.
Need to make sure you identify
yourself. Oh, I'm sorry. I just fired right in. I'm Lenny Quackenbush. I'm with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I'm the manager of the operations section, private forest program.
Thank you.
Excuse me.
Okay.
House Bill 3616 directed the Departments of Agriculture and Forestry to re-implement a stewardship agreement program that would be a joint program between the two agencies. We completed that work last year, working with a Rules Advisory Committee, and in that process, we kind of came to the conclusion that the stewardship agreement, as it was envisioned, was a good foundation and a good start towards trying to create some real incentives for both agriculture and forest landowners. However, it didn't really define specific incentives. And the vision of that original study group that recommended it said, as we see incentives, we can hang them on the stewardship agreement. As we started working with our legislative, our general counsel, our attorneys, they really recommended that we come back and seek more specific authorization for some of these incentives that were envisioned in that process. So 2114 lays out a series of incentives that we are suggesting through specific statutory authority. The first one that we are seeking is some form of a financial incentive or a cost share support for forest landowners in particular. And we have laid that out in three different formats. One would be a stewardship agreement fund, as was mentioned, that would be specific to these agreements. We have not at this point sought funding support or identified funding for that. This is to request kind of the authority to develop that. Part of our concern in that is that for the forest landowners in particular, the federal programs, which have been very important in the past, are fading away. And when we deal with non-industrial forest landowners, they tell us that those funds are just not particularly accessible to them. We feel that that support in encouraging them to do active management is crucial in encouraging them to keep that land in forest. The second process that would be possible is the flexible incentives account. This was authorized previously. It's on the books, but it is also not funded. Our proposal would be to simply add stewardship agreements as one of the methods or the qualifications for accessing flexible incentive account funding should that funding become available in the future. The third process that we suggested was to simply mention stewardship agreements as one of those avenues that would be a potential access to the Watershed Improvement Grant Fund. Now, frankly, we've had some further discussions with the Watershed Enhancement Board, and they have indicated to us that they feel that authority is there without adding this. So as we move forward with this proposal, the Department of Forestry is very amenable to dropping that particular section out of the proposal. The next section of the bill is a first attempt to define regulatory certainty. This was identified and is actually in the existing statute as a potential benefit of having a stewardship agreement, but it did not come to a specific conclusion of what a regulatory certainty would look like. We have added two processes, one at the state level, that as someone entered into a stewardship agreement and they agreed for a particular rule that they would manage above and beyond what the regulatory requirements are, that they would receive a level of certainty that should that regulation at some time in the future increase, they would not have to move up to the higher standard should it exceed what they'd already agreed to do. I kind of describe that as the early adopter, the person who goes above and beyond sooner gets a reward later. The second part of that, and where regulatory certainty is probably more commonly thought of, is in connection with the Federal Endangered Species Act. And we would propose some possibilities of entering into agreements between the Department of Forestry and the federal agencies. And they call those safe harbor agreements or candidate conservation agreements, where we kind of lay out some standards and say, if you manage to this standard and as a result you attract an endangered species, the fact that you attracted that endangered species is not going to impinge on your future ability to manage your land. That type of agreement is in use in a number of southern states, specifically with the red-cockaded woodpecker. And the federal agencies are really encouraging this because, number one, it's voluntary. Number two, the landowner is dealing with the state. the individual landowner is not dealing with the federal agencies. Some individual landowners would prefer not to work with some of those federal agencies. So this is a process of kind of getting that benefit without that fear of working with those federal agencies. The next section of the bill recreates a benefit that actually existed before. The stewardship agreement used to be a part of the Forest Practices Act, and it was focused strictly on forest operations. With the stewardship agreement, you did not have to prepare individual written plans every time you conducted an operation. That was somewhat inadvertently taken out when they pulled the entire Stewardship Act out of the Forest Practice Act and recreated it as a separate statute. So our proposal would be to add that benefit back in. And finally, there's the question of public records exemption. Under the old stewardship agreement plan, we had one major company that started down the path, and when it came to the requirement to publicize their company management plans, they withdrew. There are concerns from some of the private landowners that this public exposure, this public release of their private management plans. So as we've framed this, what we've tried to do is to differentiate between the management plan and the stewardship agreement. With our proposal, we would like to have the management plan, which contains the specific intentions and goals and information of the landowner, would be protected from public disclosure. As you note in my written testimony, there's some concerns about that. The way we did it was to add another numbered exemption to public records disclosure in ORS 192-502. There's some concerns about that, and we're working with interested parties and potentially would come back to you with a suggestion of adding that in as an example someplace in 192-501. My understanding is 502 is absolute. 501 can be challenged. So it would, for all intents and purposes, be protected from disclosure, but with arguments of overriding public interest, those things could be challenged. In summary, Department of Forestry supports this 2114. We acknowledge that we need to do a little more work to solve a couple of those questions on wording, and we would like to move that forward and come back to you with some revised wording on a couple of those sections.
Thank you. Any questions?
I'm assuming, Mr. Chair, they're coming back with the amendments then.
Yes, they will be coming back with amendments. And I would assume that they work with other people who have raised those concerns in doing so.
That's right.
Okay. Seeing no questions, we'll probably have another chance when it comes back, so thank you. Next, we have Cheryl from the Defenders of Wildlife.
Hi, good afternoon, and thanks for the opportunity, Chair Roblin and the rest of the committee, to talk about this bill. My name is Cheryl Hummon, and I'm the Senior Conservation Incentive Specialist with Defenders of Wildlife in West Lynn. A little history of our involvement with stewardship agreements. Defenders of Wildlife was very involved in the incentives legislation both in 2001 and 2003 that Lanny referred to, as well as the interim conservation incentives work group. And so we've been involved with revising the stewardship agreements program since 2001. And I'm here to support the bill with several modifications. So I'd like to briefly discuss what those are, and they are in writing just about in front of you now. So, and anything I don't mention, we support. So I'm only going to discuss the parts that that we'd like to see some revisions on. Referring to sections 1 and 2 of the bill, this is the Stewardship Agreement Grant Fund. We do understand and sympathize with the forestry community that funding for private forest landowners for voluntary conservation is slim to none. There's not a lot of funding available. It keeps disappearing. It's a serious problem. However, we're not persuaded that this separate fund needs to be created in order to provide access to funding should it become available. We feel that if some forestry-specific funding was identified, it could be delivered through the existing flexible incentives account with the change that you see in Section 3, which adds stewardship agreements to be able to access that account. So in our view, it's a little redundant, and also because this the statutory changes to the stewardship agreements were intended to be parallel for the Departments of Forestry and Agriculture, this clause is written only for forestry, and we just like to keep the whole program really aligned between the two departments for the greatest possible coordination between them. The next thing I'd like to mention is the Watershed Improvement Grant Fund. Lanny explained that the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board feels that the statutory change is unnecessary. We agree, and we support Section 4 being dropped out of the bill. Moving on to Section 5, Subsection 7, Regulatory Certainty for State Regulations. Lanny described very well what the intent of the Rules Advisory Committee was with state regulatory certainty. The intent is that on a case-by-case basis, a stewardship agreement can allow a landowner to basically have a specific state regulation frozen if they have agreed to exceed it, if that regulation was to be increased in the future. And Lanny explained the concept very well. The way Section 5, Subsection 7 is written is rather obtuse and doesn't really indicate that this would be used on a case-by-case basis and for a specific regulation. The way it's written, it appears to give sort of a blanket freezing of all regulations. It's just not clear what regulations it would refer to. And so we'd like to tighten the language up and have the language actually reflect what the Rules Advisory Committee had agreed to unanimously. The second piece of paper that you have with just a short paragraph on it is proposed alternative language that could be substituted for what's there now, which gets at the intent that the Rules Advisory Committee had agreed to. And that's it. So in summary, we support the bill, and we just have those minor changes we'd like to make. We've been working closely with the Department of Forestry and the other partners on stewardship agreements. We're happy to continue doing that. And thank you for your time.
Any questions? I have just one. In doing away with the first fund, you indicated it's possible in the flexible incentives account to have a sub-account in that that would say it's just for forestry. If money came in, it was dedicated that way?
I can't say technically what it would be called. I don't know if it's a sub-account, but the flexible incentives account can, the funding that goes through it needs to meet the criteria that OWEB as an agency needs. But in addition to that, there could be a source of funding that comes in that's specifically only for forest owners, or it could be only for oak habitat restoration or only for fish or only for something else. I'm not sure if it's a sub-account or how that would work, but we see no problem if there's a source of funding identified that is earmarked, you know, specifically for forestry to send it through the flexible incentives account.
And have they done that in the past?
The flexible incentives account has not yet had any money in it.
That's what I thought. That's why I'm hopeful that that's true. I just want to make sure that it is true.
I think for the final answer on that, I think you can ask the next speaker who is with OWEB, and they can probably clarify that for certain.
Representative Dingfeld.
I think I'll wait until OWEB comes up because I had a question and was hoping that OWEB would come up.
Okay.
I believe they're planning to testify.
They are, but okay. They're two away, but they're close.
Okay. I'll wait.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Next, we have Sarah Myers from the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association.
Good afternoon. Chair Roble, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Myers, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. As the Department of Forestry had testified previously, we do have some concerns with the placement of an additional unconditional exemption within the public records statutes as stated in Section 7 of the bill. We are in open conversation with them regarding a workable solution to that. We're simply not convinced that a blanket exemption of the land management plans is an appropriate solution, and we've recommended another solution that is based in existing statute for the protection of proprietary information that may be contained within such plans. We do look forward to bringing that amendment and that solution back to this committee at that time as such that the Legislative Council can draft that, and look forward to bringing that back to your for your consideration.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, this is not a question for the witness,
okay.
But for and I don't think Department of Ag is here, but I'm just curious. I mean, we do landowner agreements through the CRP, CERP, wetland, and, you know, all these different agricultural agreements, and I just was curious if
they had the same kind of
concerns or if they've ever had any language. I mean, we do those types of agreements all the time, and I don't know if the Department of Forestry can address that, but that's just something that we may want to. I had the same concern that was raised. I mean, it's a pretty broad exemption.
We'll bring forestry back.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Lanny Quackenbush again. There is a protection under the federal processes. So when conservation plans are completed with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, there is a consideration of confidentiality on those. I'm not personally aware how complete that is, whether it's 100%. I do know that it has been challenged because of the interaction between the federal agencies where the protection exists and conservation districts up in the state of Washington. They were forced to reveal those, and they attempted a legislative solution up there last session for them and did not pass it through. But there is a protection under the federal law that doesn't exist under state.
And do we know if, since this is a combined bill for ag and forestry, do we know if ag is also online with this, or do we need to call them here?
You know, I probably should have brought them up. Because of the focus of many of the ag programs through the federal agencies, you know, in all fairness, I think this is more important to forest landowners than it is to the ag community. We have worked with them through the administrative rule process. We talked to them when we started drafting these, and they really felt that, you know, these things were more important to the forestry community. So I think I can say with confidence they don't object to them. And as kind of a side note, when we drafted that stewardship incentives account fund, we proposed that to be joint between the two agencies, and Legislative Council told us we couldn't do that, that we couldn't do an appropriation that would go to two agencies. So that's where it kind of shifted back to the forestry account or the Department of Forestry.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a follow-up question while we have the Department of Forestry back up here? Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this was sparked by the testimony from the Defenders of Wildlife regarding Section 1.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us why you had recommended, or whoever had drafted the bill, having the separate account versus having it under the existing authority in Section 3 with a flexible incentives account? And the reason I ask the question is because, you know, one, I see agencies, and I'm on the Ways and Means Committee, and I see agencies come through, and they all want to have separate accounts that take grant administration, grant criteria, and it takes FTE to administer those. And we have an agency, OWEB, that they pretty much administer grants. So I guess I ask that of almost every agency. Can we sort of look at OWEB doing that because they're already set up for grant administration. So I guess I just want to know, was there some special consideration or discussion about why having a separate account?
I think it was two things, and you probably described them, Representative Dingfelder and members of the committee. I think it was a little bit of probably what you said, control, that if we have the account and we're deciding who it goes to, then we're kind of more in control of our destiny. I'll be honest with that.
I don't think I'd use the word control, but maybe it was implicit in what I said.
Been, it has been used in other people talking to me. So
okay. And just the final would be, would there be an FTE? I mean, we'll be able to ask you these questions in ways and means, but I'm just curious if there is an FTE or part of an FTE that would be associated with implementation of that fund and reviewing the grant applications. And having been involved in several grant programs, I am well aware of how much work it entails, depending on the amount of applications, obviously, that comes in.
Chair Roblin, Representative Dingfelder, we actually have an existing program set up within our agency, Forest Land Incentives Program, which has been funded in the past by the federal government grants. So we have the mechanism in place, and we have the administrator, if you will, at the grant level in place. If funding came into this, there would be a demand for the individuals on the ground providing technical assistance to work with individual landowners. And we did propose a POP, which has been withdrawn, that would add people in the field. We did not suggest that it would take additional administrative time because we already have that in place.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Before Mr. Quackenbush.
Mr. Quackenbush,
before you get away, Mark. I wanted to hear from your perspective. What is the rationale for the for including the public records exception that the newspaper folks were objecting to?
Chair Rowland, Representative McPherson, as was mentioned, their landowners are very reluctant to have their private goals and objectives and management plans and their business plans subjected to public scrutiny. It's long been an issue with landowners both in the ag community and in the forestry community. Under the previous stewardship agreement as it existed under the Forest Practice Act, that was a requirement when some industry went forward with it. They came to that point and they said, no, we're not going to enter into a stewardship agreement because it requires this public publishment of their personal business plans.
Follow up if I could?
Yes.
But the thrust of the bill is to create a grant process where their funds that are through state sponsorship are flowing to maintain the stewardship purposes. And so isn't that a kind of a sort of a reasonable connection to receiving those monies, that there be some in public awareness of how it's being spent?
Representative McPherson, again, the management plan, which we're proposing would be restricted access, is different than the stewardship agreement, which would be public. And the stewardship agreement would define that interaction between the state and the private landowner. So that part of it would definitely be public. The management plan, which is the part that contains that private information, is the only part that we're proposing would be protected.
Okay, I understand now. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you again. Tom Weiler from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Oh, well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Weiler with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and I do appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today to speak to a couple of sections of House Bill 2114, which you've already heard about, and I won't go into a whole lot of detail, but I wanted to give you some context about the relationship, or at least the potential relationship between OEB and its grant program and stewardship agreements. OEB's core function is to administer a grant program with specific intent on making investments with on volunteer conservation investments with local landowners across the state to improve water quality and improve habitat for fish and wildlife purposes. Our main funding source is ballot measure 66 lottery funds, which are dedicated by the Constitution. We do have several statutory vehicles for receiving funds, and those are two of those are contained in this bill in sections 3 and 4, and those are the sections that I'm interested in talking with you today about. But one main point I want to emphasize is that to the extent that stewardship agreements also foster local voluntary cooperative conservation with private landowners, we certainly want to partner with the Department of Forestry and those landowners as stewardship agreements are developed. And we look forward to opportunities to do that in the future. And with respect to Section 3, the Flexible Incentives Account, as you've heard, we have not had funding in that account to date. Adding language to allow for stewardship agreements to be funded in that account is certainly acceptable from our perspective. I think it's probably allowable, arguably, under the current statute. But since we have no experience in operating that fund, I don't think there's any harm in allowing some clarification with respect to that statute. Section 4 is our Watershed Improvement Grant Fund. We have a long history, relatively long history with our agency. We haven't been around that long, but we do have quite a history of operating that grant fund. And there, I strongly believe that the authority is there in the existing statute, and there's no need to add additional clarification. And, in fact, it's our desire to try to keep as much flexibility as possible within the statutes for that program so that we can meet the variety of needs out there. And we stand ready and willing and able to work with forestry as stewardship agreements are developed and completed to help try to find funding for those for elements of those agreements. With that, I'll be happy to respond to any questions.
I'll ask my one that I asked before. Do we know, since we've never had any money in our flexible account, do we know that we can have dedicated funds within it to go to particular things?
Mr. Chair, absolutely, yes. We have that frequently with our funding, and we receive federal funds that have strings tied attached to them, and we operate within those boundaries as we distribute the grant funds.
Okay. Other questions?
No, I think I basically asked mine to the Department of Forestry. But
okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who is here that would like to speak to House Bill 2114? Seeing no one, we will close our hearing on House Bill 2114. And we have just a couple more bills, okay, or LC drafts we want to make that we want to put into committee bill. So I will open a work session to possibly introduce some committee bills.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 2562 and LC 2566 be introduced as committee bills.
Representative Smith moves LC 2562 and LC 2566 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Representative Oakley.
Well, Chair, I have concern on the timing of one of them, considering that the action we took in the last session, and we're now waiting 2 years later, but I have no problem with them being drafted.
Okay.
I have questions on your point, though.
Yep. And as I stated the last time we did some committee bills, introduction has nothing to do with support. So,
Chair, I'm aware of that.
Okay.
One must use every opportunity when he learns the minority.
Clearly understood.
Or the majority.
Any other discussion with regard to these? Seeing none. Those of the opinion that LC 2562 and LC 2566 should be introduced as committee bills will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The assistant will call roll.
Representative Klein?
Aye.
Representative Dinkfelder?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Excused.
Representative Mallon?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Boker?
Aye.
Chair Roebling?
Aye. So, hopefully introduce them. I guess I should introduce those as committee bills. Thank you. I could have done it the other way. We'll close the work session on possible introduction of bills. Any other issues with respect to
I just have a point of clarification. I'm assuming since on 24 or 2114 there were at least questions in all but one section, if not amendments on all but one section, that this one's going to come back for another hearing at a later time with more definitive.
And with some amendments, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Any other questions? Seeing none, we will close this meeting on the Ag and Natural Resources Committee.
We have no hearing on Tuesday, is that correct?
We have no hearing on Tuesday.
Oh. You're setting a bad example because all my folks want to know why we meet so much on my committee.
It's the first one we have.